Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to do the first part of Chapter 9 of The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, published back in 1977, a serious intellectual feminist. We've been hearing about Margaret Fuller. Let's now dig into Chapter 9. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and ultimately archived at alexlinder.com. We're going to do page 349 to 367. Chapter 9, Herman Melville and the Revolt Against the Reader, The Masculine Inheritance. On March 20th, 1846, Margaret Fuller left a note on Horace Greeley's desk asking for a copy of Taipei, I'm not sure how that's pronounced. Herman Melville, I've read it and I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Herman Melville's recently published narrative of a South Sea adventure. Everett Duyckinck, D-U-Y-C-K-I-N-C-K, a prominent New York literary man and a friend of Melville's, had brought the book Melville's first to Fuller's attention. South Sea Adventure. Her review appeared in the Tribune on April 4th. Again, 1846. The conjunction of critic and author was a fortuitous and significant one. Melville was to be, with Fuller, among the few genuine romantics America produced in this period. He was to share both her dislike of the dishonesty of sentimentalism and her pervasive concern with the meaning of history. Fuller's review of Taipei stands out among contemporary appraisals. They were largely favorable, and hers was no exception, but she especially commended exactly what other readers condemned. After superficially praising Melville's pretty and spirited pictures and arch manner, she endorsed, with obviously quickened interest, Melville's skepticism about the value of the missionary effort in the Pacific. In Melville's opinion, the do-gooders, in their ignorance and scorn of indigenous culture, were corrupting, not converting, the natives. Fuller agreed. Indeed, only Margaret Fuller, with her brilliant tactlessness, could have counseled, as she did here, that the ladies' sewing societies engaged in outfitting missionaries read this book aloud while assembled at their work. Direct quote. Impatient as ever with pious endeavors conducted with more attention to the self-esteem of their subjects than concern with the needs of their objects, Fuller, like Melville, wanted her society to face, at the very least, what it was doing. I'm doing good. Myopic. Concern with internal, emotional matters rather than objective external reality. That mentality is with us still, of course. Fuller ignored the art of Taipei and the complex personality and ambush behind it to focus on the book's possible didactic and corrective intent, but she at once grasped and met Melville's preoccupation with veracity. Although Melville was a New Yorker and in the city shortly before Fuller left it to go abroad, there is no evidence that he met her. There is reason to believe, however, that he would have respected her and her work had he known them. Traveling to England in 1849, he amused himself with Holidays Abroad by Caroline Kirkland, a pragmatic, witty, and gifted writer, and commented enthusiastically, "She is a spirited, sensible, fine woman." Melville did not expect intelligence in women. In curious ways, Fuller did not either, under existing circumstances, but he felt the dearth of discernment in his environment too sharply not to prize it wherever he found it. Later, Melville read Madame de Stael with deep pleasure, noting in his journal, "It is delightful as well as wonderful to see such penetration of understanding in a woman who at the same time possesses so femininely emotional a nature." Melville could here be paraphrasing more calmly Fuller's anguished cry, "Will there never be a being to combine a man's mind and a woman's heart?" Fuller was a feminist. Melville was not. Yet, both saw the tragic segregation of the sexes in America as evidence of a deeper and even more troubling bifurcation in their culture, that between what Edwards A. Park had called the intellect and the feelings. Melville confronted this bifurcation with a particular kind of skill which Fuller's special needs and circumstances had not left among her options. On the most obvious level, Melville, unhampered by Fuller's almost compulsively strident ethicality and her culturally imposed difficulties with literary production, was a creative writer and a great one, as she was not. While he distrusted fiction no less than she, Melville could, by complex and brilliant tactics of displacement, use and expand the narrative form itself to express his hostility to it. Both Fuller and Melville were constantly experimenting as writers in radical ways. Fuller tried poetry, fiction, scholarly essays, critical journalism, history. Melville produced reviews, romances, sketches, narratives of every kind, short stories, verse. Yet where Fuller seems to be picking up a series of disparate modes and trying each in turn, Melville is apparently engaged in one continuous process of evolvement to which the varying forms are subordinate. Fuller is like someone trying on different articles of clothing, Melville like someone making alterations in a single garment. Fuller, as I have tried to show, was persistent in her search for authenticity, but she was capable, and fortunately so, of discarding almost entirely a solution whose limited potential she had exhausted. She could talk to Emerson, she could work with the transcendentalist, she could engage in protest against American apathy, she could write fiction, poetry, or criticism, only so long. She had, finally, to put herself first. If such activities or people were not ultimately going to further her goal of self-fulfillment, she had to abandon them. She disengaged from Emerson, she broke with the traditionalists, she expatriated, she failed to perfect a literary technique. Like a person running from a burning building, she took what she could, the essentials, she consigned much to inevitable destruction, she was embattled in ways that made it imperative for her to turn ideas into slogans. This is hardly to criticize Margaret Fuller. On the contrary, what revolutionary does not simplify? And what could display more intelligence than Fuller's profound understanding that the only viable role for a woman like herself at the juncture at which she lived was an essentially revolutionary one? Melville's case and his consequent greatness, however, were different. It seems natural to me, says Douglas, to discuss Fuller's achievement in large part in terms of her life, Melville's in terms of his books. I am aware of the disparity in my treatment of these two, to use one of Melville's favorite words, phenomenal people, and I do not mean to suggest that Fuller's work was not integral to and representative of her life, or that Melville's life was not intricately responsible for his creative effort and exemplary in itself. Melville's life was difficult as surely as Fuller's writing was daring. With his once prosperous father's death in 1832, when he was 13, Melville was precipitated into the American experience of downward social mobility in a way unique among the major writers of his generation. His early and wide-ranging career as a sailor, his subsequent settling into a curiously unimaginative marriage, and his increasing commitment to a literary career, which he invented with a radical fierceness unparalleled in American letters, his struggle simply to support himself and his large family, his touchingly truncated literary friendships, most notably with Hawthorne, his growing personal and professional isolation, his mounting anxiety bordering on insanity, occasionally, his final occupation as a New York customs official, which blanketed the last three decades of his life, all these facts comprise a history integral to the often painful story of our culture's potentiality for self-realization. So it's what you do in spite of what you have to do, almost. Found in difficult circumstances, yet he overcame them. Yet given the limits of space, I think my emphasis, Fuller's biography, Melville's opus, is right. Indeed, the emphasis is less mine than America's. Melville's identity was conflicted and precarious, but he did not have to make it up in the same way that Fuller was forced to hypothesize hers. There already existed in American thought an ambivalent concept of the masculine, original genius, for which there was no genuine feminine equivalent, and which Melville could adapt, if at great cost, to his own ends. Melville's cruelest critics mocked his clear determination to be a genius. They called him insane, But they never suggested, as Fuller's enemies and her friends did, that he was a freak. Melville persevered in the argument he understood to be his own. He refused to alter the terms, for that would be to alter the problem, and the problem itself was what he had to solve. His identity was bound up with it, but finally his identity was distinct from it. He possessed, in some professional sense, not altogether culturally available to Fuller, work. During Melville's visit to Hawthorne in Liverpool in 1856, the two men took a walk by the sea and resumed an old discussion on the possibility of belief. Hawthorne was struck with Melville's characteristic tenacity on this subject as on every other, a tenacity that clearly came less from hope than from a sense of respect for the issues he raised. Block quote, "It is strange how he persists," Hawthorne wrote, "and has persisted ever since I knew him, and probably long before, in wandering to and fro over these deserts, as dismal and monotonous as the sand hills amidst which we were sitting. He can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, and he is too honest and courageous not to try to do one or the other. He has a very high and noble nature." That's Hawthorne on Melville. One remembers Thomas Carlyle's similar tribute to Fuller's truly high, direct quote, nature, her, quote, "chivalrous nobleness, a tout épreuve," after meeting her in London in 1846. Yet the reasons for Carlyle's admiration were different from those Hawthorne adduced in praise of Melville. Carlyle had never, he wrote to Emerson, witnessed a desire as intense as Fuller's to consume the universe as if it were her oyster, quote, "to be absolute empress of all height and glory in it that her heart could conceive." Fuller's emphasis was on possession, Melville's on comprehension. Melville, as a man, was surer of his inheritance than Fuller could be as a woman. His effort was to deal with it. The essential dilemma in all Melville's work is that of responsibility. It is clear to Melville always that he has a legacy, although it may be a useless one, like Redburn's outdated guidebook, or even a murderous encumbrance, like the waterlogged and overconspicuous, quote, "white jacket." It is perhaps grandiose, yet I think essentially accurate, to say that Melville conceived of America itself in some genuine sense as his inheritance and his burden. America was the problem he had to comprehend. Like Fuller, Melville felt profound bitterness on occasion about his country. It is impossible, nonetheless, to imagine him relocating his patriotism as she did. Fuller apologized at various points for having apprenticed herself to European rather than American minds. She never truly shifted her intellectual allegiances, however. She knew the European minds were the best minds, and her commitment to the best was precisely analogous to her commitment to herself. Although Melville's serious career began when he immersed himself in reading the great European masters, past and present, although he absorbed voraciously what they had to teach him, he did not write directly about them or from their models. Indeed, no American author clung more tenaciously to American material than Melville. Whitman, of course, is as consistently wedded to American subjects as Melville, more so, in fact, but the connection is experienced as inevitable, assumed. Whitman's work does not revolve, as Melville's in part does, around the felt denial of the impulse to abjure America. Melville's later narratives, most notably The Confidence Man, cleave to American materials with almost punitive vengeance. This, one feels Melville saying, is my subject. All of Melville's writing is alive with his, at times, outraged conviction that he cannot produce a work significantly better than his culture. With the exception of portions of Redburn and Israel Potter, Melville debars himself in his major works from the use of European settings. The only alien civilizations Melville allows his readers contact with are those of the South Seas, precisely those which Americans and Europeans were then in the process of destroying. The non-American world, Melville shows us, is the arena for American acquisitiveness. The seas are the locale where Americans conduct their fishing industries and their wars. The South Sea Islands are the places to which they send their missionaries and their sailors. The non-American world of Melville's narratives is one by definition mutilated by America. Through his main semi-autobiographical characters, usually American sailors and soldiers, Melville acknowledged himself as protagonist and victim of America's imperialism. He denied himself use of the resources of older and richer cultures. Melville defined the test which every formidable American author in his day and since has had to impose on himself: how to exploit and resist the crude American material which both enriches and impoverishes the writer. How to take the exact measure of the reader who belongs to and is that material, how to know him utterly and intimately without being absorbed by him. Before Melville started to write, Edgar Allan Poe had dramatized the dilemma in his detective tales. Poe's detective figure, Auguste Dupin, D-U-P-I-N, explains on one occasion that in trying to solve any case, he must put himself precisely in the place of the criminal involved, trace his footsteps, think his thoughts. Little wonder that Dupin, impoverished, obsessive, secretive, resembles the insane and criminal narrators of Poe's horror tales. The only difference between Poe's detective and his criminal is that while both imagine the crime, the detective does not commit it. Increasingly over the course of Melville's career, his protagonist, Ishmael Pierre, Captain Amasa Delano, the lawyer in Bartleby the Scrivener, come to mind, become proto-detectives, and Melville's own undoubtedly hostile conception of the American writer's task becomes exactly that of imagining his society's crime without enacting it. In paradoxical fashion, Melville committed himself to a self-selected crime to ensure himself against the crimes of sentimentality and effeminacy which he was recording and protesting in his society. "I would like to argue," says Douglas, "that the crime Melville picked as his own was masculinity itself, just as Fuller, I might add, chose femininity, as she conceived it, as her sin. This was possible precisely because of the fact that, when sex roles are as utterly stereotyped as they were in 19th century America, genuine sexual identity becomes by definition, and perhaps this was the point, illicit." Certainly Melville was as deeply and broadly concerned with manhood as Fuller was with womanhood. She used her life as her main vehicle of definition. He his work, but the concern was the same. Fuller perceived that women would be afraid to think when thinking made them outcasts. Melville came to see more and more clearly the other side, that a culture which gave feminine antinomianism privileged status would be forced to treat and distort masculinity as a species of outlawry, whether opposed as immoral or abetted as titillating. This is not to suggest that masculinity was Melville's only preoccupation, or that he conceived of it in simplified and primarily sexual terms. Melville's essential struggle was to widen and make complex definitions which his culture conspired to narrow. He conceived masculinity, as Fuller understood feminism, essentially as resistance to sentimentalism, as an effort at a genuinely political and philosophical life. Melville was never unaware that the American reading public consisted largely of middle-class women whose domesticated and at times insidious piety was buttressed and catered to by large segments of the clerical and literary establishment. In Pierre, 1852, Melville presents a savage study of the conspiratorial interaction between genteel religion, feminine morality, and polite literature against the interests of genuine masculinity. Early in the book, Melville introduces us to a clergyman called Reverend Falsgrave, a self-made elegant temporizer, a lover of choice female companionship, and the author of, quote, various fugitive pieces upon subjects of nature, art, and literature. Falsgrave is totally dependent upon his female parishioners, most notably the widowed Mrs. Glendinning, Pierre's mother, whom he wishes to marry. By necessity, he must fail the male members of the congregation. Pierre is involved in a special crisis. He has discovered, or so he thinks, that his father secretly sired an illegitimate daughter before marrying his mother. What should he think of his dead father, revealed as a seducer? How should he treat that daughter, now discovered? The case is complicated by a neighborhood scandal. Deli, a lower-class girl, is pregnant and unmarried. The local community, indifferent to the wrongdoing of the man involved, wants to drive her away. Pierre can hardly miss the analogies with his father's past. Deli might be his father's mistress, hounded and persecuted while he was allowed to go free. Pierre poses his dilemma, suitably disguised as concern for Deli's case, in front of his mother, to Falsgrave. Falsgrave cannot handle the problem, partly because he is too weak to possess any genuine ethical system of values. His arena is social and literary, not religious, and partly because he must follow Mrs. Glendenning's lead. And she refuses to deal honestly with the situation, since to do so would be to remind herself of the limits of her power, precisely those imposed by the complex imperatives of male sexuality. Easier simply to condemn Deli, the woman in the case, as Mrs. Glendinning does, than to scrutinize what she cannot control, the male seducer. The woman and the minister conspire to ignore the facts. Pierre is totally disillusioned with both of them, yet he himself has exemplified Melville's awareness of the special taint of American culture. Before his encounter with his illegitimate half-sister, Isabel, he publishes a number of sentimental effusions in polite periodicals. Critics praise Pierre's productions for their smoothness and gentleness, 342, their lack of vulgarity and vigor, direct quote, and their suitability to the, quote, family circle. The enterprising editors engineering the sentimental market asked to publish his collected works in a fashionably thin volume. Pierre modestly considers himself as yet too young for such a proceeding, not realizing, Melville bitterly adds, that most popular writers are, quote, legal minors forced to go to their mamas for pennies to keep them in peanuts, 349. Countless young ladies send their albums for Pierre's autographs. He dismisses a stack of such volumes with a graciously cavalier kiss. Like any genteel poeticizer of the day, Pierre pens sentimental obituary verse. He dedicates one poem to, quote, the late Reverend Mark Graceman, 345. Pierre abandons this conventional literary career and his popularity when he flees to New York to live with Isabel, but Melville has successfully exposed its effeminate, juvenile, hypocritical, and essentially mercenary nature. So instead of writing crud for women, you should be writing real stuff for men. That's the masculine role, I think, is what is going on here. Pierre's first work is a sonnet entitled The Tropical Summer, clearly a satiric reference to Melville's early successful South Seas narratives. Yet Melville never tried to court the feminine market as Pierre does. From the start of his career, he expected an indifferent or hostile response from women readers. Writing to Richard Dana in 1849, he acknowledged that White Jacket was, quote, man of warish in style, rather aggressive, I fear. The source of his fear is clear when he expressed his surprise to Sophia Hawthorne a few years later that she should like Moby Dick, quote, for as a general thing, he wrote her, women have small taste for the sea. He cautioned another feminine acquaintance to have nothing to do with the same novel, quote, don't you buy it, and don't you read it when it does come out, because it is by no means the sort of book for you. It is not a piece of fine feminine Spitalfield silk, but it is of the humble texture of a fabric that should be woven of ship's cables and hawsers. A polar wind blows through it, and birds of prey hover over it, warn all gentle and fastidious people. So he's writing for rough men, not refined women. Significantly, Melville received less critical and popular support than did any other major American writer of his day or since, nor did he court it. He was only concerned about the excellence of his work, and he was rewarded by history because he would have produced, many would say, the greatest novel of the 19th century, at least one of the top three, in Moby Dick, which is a fantastic work. So he received less critical and popular support than any other major American writer of his day, and he didn't court that support. He dismissed White Jacket and Redburn, two of his finest early works, which were well-received, as mere trash written to get money. He wanted, he said, to write those kind of books which are, quote, said to fail, and he did. We see here a version of the narcissistic rage which propelled Harriet Beecher Stowe into the publication of Lady Byron Vindicated. Both Stowe and Melville felt profoundly hostile before a culture whose most basic assumptions opposed their full maturation. But while Stowe in her anger tragically, if inevitably on occasion, lumped the best of her oppressors with the worst of them, Melville never lost sight of who his enemy was. It was always the absence of critics whose judgment he could respect which triggered his rage. Stowe's dilemma was such that she was forced to be willing to settle for an audience. Melville held out hopelessly, even vindictively, for an audience of his peers. Nor was his preoccupation with failure finally kin to that of the male sentimentalist. They advertised the modesty of their ambition, in part from guilt, in part from a desire to redefine success to fit their own image. Melville soon acknowledged his ambition to write great books which would fully utilize the most demanding and ambiguous material America offered, but he flatly proclaimed that there were few in America to aid or appreciate his attempt. Melville regarded the reception of his books as a test which would ascertain what genuine masculinity, or, as he tacitly defined it, what health and independence of mind remained in American culture. The content and style of his work were to register his increasingly bitter disillusion with his experiment. Melville's subject came to be his readers and his disappointment with them. So he tried very hard. He produced a great work. Even if he didn't receive a lot of money for it or recognition in his own time, he still did excellent work because he had the right idea, the right approach. He understood the right problem. He chose the right giant problem to tackle and did it very successfully. Read Moby Dick. It's fantastic work, as I've said for the second time. That ends that subsection, and we've got one more here. The early works, The Uncontested Space. Melville's early narratives, Typee, 1847, Omu, 1847, Redburn, 1849, White Jacket, 1850, so all those 1847 to 1850, Typee, Omu, Redburn, White Jacket, all enjoyed a real, if limited, popularity. They represent Melville's original acceptance by one segment of the American reading public, those interested in adventure stories, his gradual need to complicate and explore that acceptance, and finally his incipient desire to question an audience whose comprehension and tolerance proved painfully inadequate. He's too big for his audience. All four books are set at sea, which for Melville was what the safari or the bullfight would be in more simplistic ways for Hemingway. An arena for the male occupations of acquisition and combat, and a preserve for specifically masculine vices and virtues. Sea narratives were attractive to Melville, as they were to the Brahmin Richard Henry Dana, because they offered their author an opportunity to introduce tough, low characters without going outside the confines of respectable literature. In the preface to Omu, Melville explains to us that whaling is, quote, a business peculiarly fitted to attract the most reckless seamen of all nations, and to foster in them a spirit of the utmost license. The narrator, the Melville persona in the early books, is, of course, better educated than his comrades, but, with the exception of Redburn, he gives his loyalty to the crew. If he is going to change at sea, it will be in only one way. The, quote, tough training, unquote, of a sailor's life, according to Melville, makes a, quote, thoroughbred tar out of any boy. And that's what a tar is, a seaman. Although Melville's viewpoint on this process is complex and compassionate, it is nonetheless true that his weak sailors, most notably Redburn's sensitive and wild English friend, Harry Bolton, fail and even die. Melville does not triumph in these facts. He regrets them, yet he records them. He's saying it's good to be strong, and you have to be strong, or you will fail and die. There are no women of any kind to speak of in Redburn and White Jacket, and the only women in Typee and Omu are Polynesians who pose few challenges to the protagonists. The famous Fayaway of Typee is a charming and sympathetic character or creature. Lovely to look at, uninhibited, tender, sensual, she understands better than any of the other Typees Tamo's needs and desires. She offers exactly what the American Victorian lady would deny her male counterpart, unmoralized pleasure. In Omu, when a native girl resists the advances of a white ship doctor, she does so clearly in a spirit of mischief and on the grounds of personal predilection. There is no moral issue involved. Melville takes pains to point the contrast between the artless vivacity and unconcealed natural graces of the Polynesian maidens and the stiffness, formality, and affectation of the woman back home. Quote, it would be the Venus de Medici placed beside a milliner's doll. Godey's Lady's Book praised Typee. The reviewer had clearly missed the challenge Melville directed to its readers. These early works, however, are only at moments conscious of feminine America at all. The issue is resistance or obedience not to female authority, but to male rule. Part of the essential Calvinism of these narratives is Melville's implicit insistence, an insistence that divides him from most of his contemporaries, including Hawthorne, that the fundamental struggle in American culture is the Oedipal one of son against father, not that of son against mother. Melville stresses everywhere the tyrannical authority the American sea captain exercises. In White Jacket, he compares Captain Claret to Henry VIII and informs us that a captain has far more power over his crew than the American president exerts over his constituents. The sly and dishonest captain of Redburn's ship is aptly named Riga, the Latin word for stick or rod. Melville's captains seldom fail to use the weapons which are metaphorically associated with them. In White Jacket, what story there is turns on several whipping incidents. Captain Claret relishes floggings. At one point, it momentarily appears that the narrative himself is going to be whipped. Determined to avoid such a humiliation, he seriously contemplates killing Claret by pushing him overboard. The Oedipal iconography could not be clearer. It is important to note at this juncture, however, that the whipping incidents seldom center merely on a personal Oedipal confrontation between the captain and a specific sailor. In every case, Melville depicts the captain as unjust. Therefore, the issue becomes whether the shipmates of the victim are going to band together to defend him or keep a cowardly peace. White Jacket is rescued from his beating and from committing murder by another sailor who dares to speak up and clear him of the offense with which the captain has charged him. Earlier in White Jacket, a man is beaten for defending a friend whom the captain is intent on flogging. At the close of the narrative, the captain willfully and unfairly orders all the crew to shave off their beards. One noble old sailor absolutely refuses. He is whipped and confined, yet still he holds firm. The other men admire him. They know his resistance is right, but they do not stand by him. It is a measure of the corruption which the prospect of shore life represents to Melville that the crew, eager to land without delay or interference, obeys the captain. In sum, the issue underlying the flogging scenes is paternalism versus fraternity, capitulating to the oppressor versus organizing the oppressed. Melville is suggesting, in profound opposition to the tendencies of his culture, that the real plot on shipboard and in the American society, which shipboard life for Melville always symbolizes, is essentially political and class-oriented. This is a difficult problem, but it seems to me Melville was perhaps the first major American author to sense that the essential question for the American writer and intellectual was whether he was going to subscribe to what would be the Freudian or what would be the Marxist analysis of his culture, whether he would focus on personality or on societal structures as the causal agent. It is worth noting that in all the narratives from which American women are excluded, Typee, Omu, Redburn, White Jacket, Moby Dick, Bartleby the Scrivener, Benito Sereno, Israel Potter, and Billy Budd, Melville is interested primarily in questions of class. The clash between employer and employed, master and slave, government and soldier. Partly in response to his own failed career, Melville was increasingly preoccupied with the lost, the overlooked, the forgotten, the obscure and the inaccessible. So, as we have seen, were many of the sentimental and religious writers of the day. But Melville's emphasis was on economic facts, not on nostalgic evasion of them. In a country as highly commercialized, as totally oriented toward publicity, as Melville's bombastic, newspaper-addicted America, he realized that fame and recognition were a sign not so much of achievement as of status. He understood that the cause of disposal was class. The class problem does not seem to exist in America, Melville was aware, precisely because the lower classes are the unscrutinized, a situation he brilliantly attempted to rectify in his depiction of common sailors, immigrants, blacks, and city clerks. The narratives, which include women, most notably Marty Pierre, Jimmy Rose, I and My Chimney, The Apple Tree Table, and The Confidence Man, are in contrast primarily psychological. The most basic questions in these works are not about class, but about emotional and spiritual health and disease, about the possibilities of communication and trust. The protagonists are mainly of the same social class, the middle class. Deli, the only lower class character in Pierre, is a very minor character. The confidence man, quote-unquote, in his various disguises, ranges from black lower class to white upper middle class. The whole point of his masquerade, however, is that he is exposing and exploiting not the class realities of America, but his fellow middle class passengers' sentimentalized response to the trappings of class. Black Guinea, the Negro beggar, receives pity and contempt. The more affluent-appearing cosmopolitan usually gets a respectful hearing. I would note also how differently Melville treats the question of money in the psychological as opposed to the class-oriented works. In the latter, money is usually spoken of frankly and specifically. We know, for example, exactly how much money Redburn and Harry Bolton are supposed to get from Captain Riga. Melville describes in detail the process by which Ishmael's and Queequeg's wages are determined, their share of the haul. In the psychological narratives, economic facts are almost entirely obscured. Their suppression is actually one of the common themes of these works. Jimmy Rose, for example, concerns a wealthy and charming man's fall from prosperity. His former friends, more or less ignoring his plight, let him drop over for tea and pretend they are not aware that such apparently casual repasts constitute his main support. In his sick old age, he is tended by a pious young girl who visits the needy in most approved sentimental fashion. She relieves Jimmy's suffering with jellies and religious tracts. Despite his habitual courtliness, one day he throws her books into a corner, muttering, quote, "Think she to solve a gentleman's heart with a poor man's plaster?" He himself cannot admit the truth about his utter deprivation, but he can no longer tolerate lies. My distinction between Melville's Marxist and Freudian work is, of course, imprecise, since all the works show the influence of both kinds of thinking, but I believe it is roughly accurate. Why does this rough distinction correspond to works without women and those with them? At some level, Melville seems to have grasped the at least outward disapproval of economic issues, which we have seen as essential to the role of the American lady. In order not to make conspicuous her lack of economic productivity, she had to ignore economics altogether. In 1836, Catherine Maria Sedgwick, whom Melville later knew in the Berkshires, published a cheery little study of the upper and lower classes entitled The Poor Rich Man and the Rich Poor Man. Its moral was that wealth has nothing to do with happiness and genuine success. Incensed at such sentimental evasion, Melville published a bitter parody in 1854, which he mockingly called Poor Man's Pudding and Rich Man's Crumbs. In Pierre, Melville explores feminine ignorance of economics more explicitly. Isabel, Pierre's sister, and Lucy, his fiancée, are living with Pierre in New York. Both are utterly reliant on him to support them. When the upper-class Lucy first moves in, she has apparently no conception of the financial difficulties her arrival causes the pinched little household. She decides to paint portraits to earn money, and Pierre lacks the heart to tell her how little difference her ladylike efforts can possibly make. If Lucy lacks class consciousness, Isabel lacks class altogether. An orphan who grew up in a series of totally anomalous situations, Isabel has only the vaguest notions of societal life, much less of economic necessity, she, of course, is incapable of doing anything to help affairs. Her superb guitar playing is the product of inspiration, a la Stowe or Sigourney. God does it, not Isabel. It is untutored and unteachable. Only Pierre has enough economic sense to feel their poverty and ignominy. In other words, class consciousness is minimized in Pierre and the other narratives I have grouped with it simply because the women whose awareness provides the male protagonist claustrophobic arena are themselves incapable of it. And hence it is a significant part of the masculine quality of the early works that the conflicts on which they turn are largely ones of class. The crucial scene for all these narratives occurs early in Redburn. Impoverished young Redburn is crossing to New York by ferry. Humiliated by the public disclosure that he has not adequate fare for his passage and must travel as a kind of charity case, he brandishes his ludicrous old hunting piece at the other prosperous passengers whose cold stares he detests. He frightens them, as he intends, and then goes to stand alone and sullen in the rain on the deck. Such, Melville summarizes grimly, is boyhood. Popular American literature in Melville's day and after was dedicated, and not totally without cause, to the effort of substituting moral, sexual, generational, and even geographical definitions for economic and class-determined ones. The good characters and the bad, the women and the men, the maid and the matron, the boy and the adult, the young and the old, the northerner, the southerner, the easterner, the westerner. Redburn's boyhood, that supposedly idyllic period, is empty and useless as a category, Melville implies. His age counts for less than his economic status. Melville's early narratives are as unyielding to the demands of sentimentalism in form as they are resistant to it in content. Over and over, Melville assures us that he will set forth things as they actually exist. He writes to, quote, correct, quote, high-raised romantic notions, unquote, about life at sea. No sentimental illusions motivate him. He will give us facts. At one point in White Jacket, he describes his purpose thus, quote, I let nothing slip, however small, and feel myself actuated by the same motive which has prompted many worthy old chroniclers to set down the merest trifles concerning things that are destined to pass away entirely from the earth, and which, if not preserved in the nick of time, must infallibly perish from the memories of men. Melville, of course, did not actually follow the facts of his own sea adventures in quite the literal-minded fashion he suggests here. He relied at times on heavily edited accounts of other travelers, and selected and edited his own experiences with care. Yet Melville is accurate in the White Jacket passage, at least insofar as he is suggesting that the impression his narrative should convey is fidelity to fact. I mean, he's making it up, but he's not making it up. Melville was, from the start, profoundly distrustful of fiction. He wrote fictionally, chiefly in what I have called the psychological works. In other words, he used fiction to write about women or worlds which had been formed by their presence, and he always used it as a mode of irony. The term fiction, as I am applying it to Melville's works, is a complicated one. Marty and Moby Dick, for example, are neither factual chronicles nor fictions. They are, rather, romances of a special kind, heightened imaginative explorations of significant events and emotions. It is crucial to Melvillian romance that both books apparently begin as accurate narratives centered in a realistic character's consciousness. They take off, quite literally, into the realm of story with Marty's quest and Ahab's appearance from this factual basis. The story, the more palpably inverted part of the book, acts as a heightening, a continuation, and a transformation of the at least avowedly factual narrative. It is always for Melville a type of necessary hubris. As such, it threatens the narrative's existence. In the unsuccessful Marty, it kills it, but it is essentially dependent on it. The story can be called to account by the narrative. Ishmael, in part, determines our responses to Ahab. Melville's fictions, in contrast to his romances, are those works such as Pierre the Confidence Man, which are deliberately irresponsible, which are at no point harnessed to a narrative sensibility we can trust. fiction is to Melville a form of deceit. Unlike Margaret Fuller, he found brilliant uses for it, but he employed it only in works like Pierre and the Confidence Man, which are profoundly concerned with sentimentalism and self-hatred. By a process of reversal typical of Melville, fiction is, in a sense, Melville's way of imitating and punishing his fiction. Hungry audience. By a process of reversal typical of Melville, fiction is, in a sense, Melville's way of imitating and punishing his fiction, hungry audience. So you say, yeah, I'm using fiction, which you like, but I'm using it to show you that you should like fact better than fiction. Among the four early books, the first two, Taipei, I think it is, and Omu, represent Melville's happiest and surest, if not his most profound examples, of the narrative form. They advertise their factual accuracy, and they reveal a total structural dependence on the nature of actual experience. What is offstage is always acknowledged. The demands of what story there is are never absolute. They never impinge on reality. If Tomo in Taipei, for example, does not know what happened to his comrade Toby after Toby left the Valley of the Taipeis, we will not find out either, although by any law of the laws of fiction we could expect to. In particular, Omu, Melville's second South Sea book, reads like an exercise in unmanipulated narrative. Melville writes in ether. All events have equal emphasis. It is the hardest of Melville's books to recall in any detail. Melville seems to be gambling in the pleasures of objectivity. If Moby Dick was to be a wicked, wicked book, direct quote, Omu is an extraordinarily innocent one. Most narratives, fictional or factual, work by a process of becoming burdened with themselves. They become curiously guilty, and this guilt is part of our times, almost compulsive involvement in them. And this guilt is part of our, at times, almost compulsive involvement in them. Omu, in contrast, is relatively eventless, and what events there are never accumulate. Each chapter seems to begin again, like a new morning. In contrast to the parasitic quality of Melville's fiction, from Pierre through The Confidence Man, Omu is a model of narrative independence, a collage of reported experience. Melville clearly does not yet feel that he must bargain with his readers and manipulate their reactions. Omu's innocence is finally dependent on its blissfully assumed ignorance of its own commercial identity. Not all the early works are so structurally joyous as Omu, or even Taipei. In publishing the wild metaphorical romance Marty, 1849, Melville gambled that the audience he had won with Taipei and Omu would be interested in what he considered his development. He lost. Despite their relatively straightforward quality, Redburn and White Jacket, which come after the critical debacle of Marty, are more complicated and conflicted in their forms, although not in their themes, than their predecessors. This disjuncture between form and theme deserves comment. It is part of Melville's special and radically inventive identity as a writer that, while he can be uncomfortably Victorian in his ideas and rhetoric, he is always incalculably, if equally, uncomfortably modern epistemologically. When we speak of experimentation, we usually mean that the experimenter is taking only 80% of his material, rather than 100%, as a given, and playing with the rest. Melville was disturbingly capable of dropping almost all assumptions, of taking nothing for granted. Whatever his literary debts, he wrote often as if no other book had ever been written or ever would be. That really is true. In his word combinations, you particularly notice that he is very free of cliché compared to most. And I don't mean by clichés just this overt stuff recognizes cliché. I mean any common combination of adjectives and nouns, unusual nouns by themselves, not just ordinary. Ordinarily, you find a normal sort of adjective coupled with a normal sort of noun. He wouldn't do not only that oppose that couplet, but he would use unusual adjectives and unusual nouns, but always intelligible. Whatever his literary debts, he often wrote as if no other book ever had been written or ever would be. This refusal to accumulate formally makes Melville less stable, and on occasion more disappointing, than any other writer of his stature, but it is essential to his lifelong purpose. structure rather than content was his most responsive register and indicator. Every change in his sensibility showed up at once as formal instability and transformation. Form was thus sensitive with Melville in part because he increasingly grasped that the author meets his reader's expectations or doesn't, earns his reader's trust or fails to, punishes or rewards the reader through form rather than through theme. In other words, form and the arousal and satisfaction of audience appetite it controls provide the negotiating ground for writer and reader. What you expect is a story, and it's going to operate like this. And he's changing around what your assumptions might be, making you uncomfortable. But that could be the uncomfortableness attending growth. Redburn's form is indicative of Melville's post-Marty uncertainty as to who his audience was and how he should treat it. So women are very happy with something that's conventional that they've seen before. They want essentially to consume a brand when they go to a book, but he's going to be a mask then. Well, he has to challenge and go new places, and the audience might not be willing to pay to go there with him. That's why he ended his life, you know, 3 decades in a counting house. So he had an actual job, even though he was, you know, one of the two greatest writers in America in the 19th century. So Redburn's form is indicative of Melville's post-Marty uncertainty as to who his audience was and how we should treat it. The book reveals a confusion of tone and persona, which makes even the work of Ick Marvel or Harriet Stowe look uncomplicated. Melville alternately informs us, condescends to us, shows off to us, and satirizes us. So we don't know where he's going. That's great. That's great. Redburn is on one page a prig who calls a gentleman a wight, a la Spencer, refuses to drink or smoke, and generally mimics the reader's presumed prudery. On the next page, he is an embittered rebel who talks bluntly and assaults the reader's complacency. Melville cannot here wed consistency of characterization with consistency of attack. Whitejacket presents a different and somewhat more skillfully handled formal problem. The protagonists are coherent, the plot is not. The story occurs, as it will always do in Melville, but here with unusual force, in segments, as pieces that the reader cannot quite fit into one puzzle. The noble and gay sailor, Jack Chase, who is above his station, the rather sad poet Lemsford, attacked by the rest of the crew, the episodes of the whipping, the enforced shearing of the sailors, they all form a partial pattern. They do not constitute events. The story seems to be mysteriously absorbed, as it will be in Moby Dick, into symbolic objects, most notably the nearly lethal jacket itself, whose meaning is never fully articulated. Melville was always more creative with nouns than with verbs. He was more likely to make up nouns from verbs than the reverse. In some roughly analogous fashion, objects in his later narratives soak up events and refuse to yield them in any accessible form. It is as if they can only give them up in the form of a highly imaginative and difficult story. The white whale's unfathomed meaning somehow secretes the Ahab section of Moby Dick. In Whitejacket, no story takes off. The narrative refuses to precipitate itself. To give birth, it is curiously sullen. As in Redburn, Melville is temporarily blurring the distinction between Marxist and Freudian material, a kind of tormented and self-conscious stasis, different from the freely willed eventlessness of Omu, intrudes almost unsought on the potential narrative development. In spots, Redburn and Whitejacket become signs of suffering rather than studies of it. The causes of Melville's pain were many, but not least among them was his growing dislike of the quote-unquote public. The partial artistic failure of Redburn and Whitejacket is both involuntary and voluntary. Melville reveals his increasing distrust of his audience by withholding his book, by refusing to perform the authorial tasks of development and reconciliation. And that's where we'll leave it today, talking about Melville. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with more from Chapter 9 of The Feminization of American Culture real soon.